My name is Harry. I'm an alcoholic.
Hello, everybody. I appreciate Tim inviting me up here. Thank you very much, Tim. And it's been a long time since up here. I've been to the NABBA Club. And I think I can see that. I used to have real good vision. There we go. I think I see that from up there. I appreciate you having me up here speaking. And I would like to introduce you to my wife-to-be. We're married on August the 4th. Kathy. Wife. Yes. My wife. It's been a month. We're newlyweds. We're married. She's my wife. Kathy's my wife. Alrighty. Whee. I'm here to share my experience, strength, and hope. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself. My father was born in Yonkers, New York. My mother was born in East Orange, New Jersey, the other country, we would say, in New York. And I was born here in Valdosta, Georgia. My father was in the Air Force at the time. And I have two brothers. And after my father got in the service, we went back to New York. And I lived there for about 18 years. My first encounter with alcohol was with my father. My father, I will say this, is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I will say that he's an alcoholic because he has admitted to it that he's an alcoholic. I will say this to you. I did not know the difference between normal and abnormal drinking. I thought the way my father drank was that's the way it was. As a child, we hung out in the bars in the city in Yonkers, Ashburton Avenue, Nappahan Avenue, the bars. The kids, us, as children, would be in the bars. While my father was in, he was either bartending. My father owned a bar at one time. I heard some stuff about horses. I'm not really sure what that was about. Something to do about numbers. I don't know what that was about, numbers and horses. I don't know. So, I mean, as a child, that's where I grew up. Didn't know the difference between abnormal and normal drinking. I thought that's when you got drunk, that's what happened. When you drank, that's what happened, you got drunk. So there was no difference to me. No difference to me at all. My first drink was at the age of 14. Now, as a kid, you know, during Christmas, we'd get a little sip or something like that, you know, just to celebrate the holidays. And my mother was not a drinker. And her side of the family, none of them drank. So I've never seen my mother intoxicated. My father was enough of an example and enough of a show to keep us all preoccupied that taking the eyesight off my mom my mom was never in focus because my father was always into some kind of trouble or doing something crazy or drinking. My father was a Dr. Jekyll personality. He was one minute he was a nice guy, next minute he was a maniac. And that's the way I grew up. My father also was also doing comedy, entertaining, and when I got old enough to play an instrument, I started playing trumpet. But when the Beatles came out, I switched to bass guitar. Something about that. I don't know what happened. You know, something about trumpet didn't fit in rock and roll or something, so I switched over. So at the age of 14, I had my first drink, and I can remember where I was. I was my father, my family had gone away, and I was supposed to take care of my two brothers, babysit them, and there was a party up the street. And by this time, my father also was involved with the grocery store. And in those days, IGA, or ShopRite, he was a manager. If you wanted a Budweiser display at the corner, the driver would say, I'll give you a couple cases. We put a Bud display here. Okay. So we had a Bud display, Schaefer display, Heck display, Beck's beer display. I mean, everywhere in that store there was display of some kind of booze. So in my point is down in the basement, we were loaded with alcohol. Loaded. So when my father went away, I thought, you know what, I'm going to try this thing about drinking. I'm not really sure what it's all about. And going downstairs, my father had a cupboard, and there was whiskey, I don't remember, scotch, whatever. And I grabbed one of those bottles, I took the cap off, and chugged it, and boy, just when that hit, it was like, wow. It was something that I had never experienced before. Another thing, too. Sobriety date, 9/8/1975. My home group is Hillside. My sponsor is Bill R. I had another sponsor named Pat W. who passed away. So Bill has been my sponsor for ever since he came down here from Chicago. And he's quite a character. I'll get into our relationship, me and Bill, here in a little bit, about some of the crazy conversations that I would call him up and how he would respond to me. But anyway, that was my first drink, blackout drinking. I continued to drink until I blacked out. The party was supposed to be up the street. The party ended up in our house. I ended up waking up the next morning. Can you hear me with this microphone? All right, just making sure. If I drift away, just say, Tim, you bring me in closer, will you, sir? Okay, Tim. So anyway, I got drunk, blacked out. I'm laying down, and I wake up, and the house was just trashed, man, and beer in ashtrays, and, you know, and somebody that robbed the house. I mean, you know, just kid stuff, taking stuff. And I never related. The problem is drinking, trouble. Those two didn't mix. I didn't put those two together. I thought maybe just a bad time, you know. So I continue to drink. And my point is this. I've never had one drink in my life. I do not know what that's like. I've never sipped a drink. I drank to get drunk. I drank for the effect. I drank to get as blasted as I possibly could. From the age of 14 to the age of 19, that's the way I drank. If you did not drink the way I did, please go do something else. You make model airplanes. I don't know. Do something. Go play baseball. But I was in the bars as soon as I could grow a mustache. I was in the bars in upstate New York, and that's the way it was for me. I played sports for a while, but it got in the way of my drinking. You know what I mean? On the weekends. And it got to be a weekly thing, even on the week. You know, I'd be hanging out in local bars. So my whole life was around drinking. So in my case, I believe I have the disease of alcoholism. All I needed was the first drink, and I was off it running at the age of 14. Do you get it? You get it. I am an alcoholic. Will always be an alcoholic. My last drink was at the age of 19 years old. I'll tell you a couple of stories. I was in the area upstate New York. There was a New Year's Eve party. I was hired by a polka band called the Paul Polanski Band. And they hired me because I could read charts. I played bass for them. And so we did this gig New Year's Eve, and they got me to play. And I sat down in, it was a Polish community in upstate New York. There was an area where there was a huge Polish community, very rich black soil. And so they were having a party. And I sat down. I sat down with this couple, and this guy poured me a drink. And the drink, the glass was almost as big as this bottle right here. And he said, why don't you take a sip out of that? And I drank the whole damn thing. He said, okay. So he went and he poured it again, filled it up to the top. And I said, I'll take a little sip out of it so you can put an ice cube in it if you want to. Not realizing by the time I got on stage, I was so out of it that all I heard, I could see the horns playing, and I could see the drummer yelling at me. But I noticed one thing very peculiar. They were dancing a slow dance, and they had this bottle over their head. And they were dancing, and the bottle was being passed. And even as I talk about it, I'm in awe. I might get lost for a second in that moment. But they were passing the bottle, and that's the only thing I can remember, is that bottle and this drummer just screaming at me, because I was totally out of it. And I think that gave me Southern Comfort, because Southern Comfort had that tendency of doing that with me. I could see with the eyes and go, holy crap, I'm falling, but have no control. Or if this drummer's yelling at me, and I could see the horns playing, but I don't know what the heck's going on. But I know, you know what I'm saying? So that was one experience with drinking. And never, needless to say, I never went back and played with the Paul Plansky band. I don't think they wanted me to play anymore with them. Well, that was my one experience. I've had many of the moments about drinking and playing. And, you know, I mean, my little town, and this was 69. In 69, when the Woodstock concert, my little town of upstate New York was bumper to bumper. Bumper to bumper. Bumper to bumper. And my house was 5 miles out from the nearest streetlight. Is anybody too young to know what remember Woodstock was? Woodstock concert? You were? Okay. Yeah, okay. He was too young for me. I mean, it was bumper to bumper. I never seen so many hippies in all my life. Long hair. I mean, it was just the craziest thing I've ever seen. So needless to say, I was attracted to that whole environment. I loved it for a while. But the problem was the blackouts. I was blacking out all the time towards the end there. You know, I ended up in New York City in a McDonald's and bam, hit my head on the wall and come out of it. And then I'd say, where am I? And you're in a McDonald's in New York. And I'm going, oh, New York City. Okay. And then, you know, there was three guys that I drank with all the time. And I remember the last time that we had drank together. They kept coming back from the service. They went back and they went to the service, two of the guys, at the tail end of the Vietnam War. And they came back and we went out on a drinking spree. And God bless Dennis Quist. Dennis Quist had the capacity to drive. He had a Camaro, 68 Camaro. That guy could drive absolutely 100% loaded in the backwoods of New York and not have an accident. I never could figure out how he would do it. So anyway, now he's a cop in New York. So he's done real well for himself. So if you're in New York on the back roads and you get a cop on your butt and he won't leave you alone, that's probably Dennis Quist. Okay, because he had that capacity. So anyway, they came back and it was a 3-day stint, a drunk. And the reason why I'm saying this is because it was the first time that I had actually had to drink myself. I was in a blackout. I remember waking up. They came and got me back up for the third day. And I remember that was the first time I had to drink just to get myself in a state of normalcy. Just to feel normal. Just to feel normal. By this time, my father had come into the program. And my father needed to be in the program. And I've said this before. He was 35, maybe 39. Was kind of old. You know, needed to retire at the age of 39. So he came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought the old man needed to do that. He needed to stop drinking. So I continued to drink. But what happened is, you people started showing up at the house. And I would come to the house, and I would smell coffee. I would smell donuts. And I would hear laughter. And I would see New York City cops in the house, which was weird. Priests at the house. And I'm going, this is the most weirdest, strangest bunch of people I've ever seen in my life, the house. I don't get it. I thought maybe my father joined some kind of occult or something. And you're all laughing. And I'm going, this is really weird. You're not drinking. But I'll tell you one thing that I noticed. I noticed something was in your eyes. Something was different about you. You had peace. I didn't know that that's what I was seeing. But I became very, very curious. And after that little 3-day stint with my buddies, they went back to the Navy. They were serving, and I thought I needed to go to my It was just the typical crap, fighting, going to a bar, getting into a brawl. Thank God they didn't have computers back then, and screaming from one town to the next. And you turn off the lights, and you're running as fast as you can, in the woods and hiding because you know where all the hiding places are. But anyway, I ended up to my first AA meeting. Called my father. I got in a brawl with some guy and ended up tearing one of my legs up. And went to my first AA meeting in North Paterson, New Jersey. My first AA meeting. I knew the jig was up. I was blacking out all the time. I was 19, blacking out. Got tired of having guys' rings in my face, pumping gas and not knowing that I'm pumping gas. Looking out where is the car in the garage? Looking out. How do I get home? with my family's car driving in and blackout. How did the car get to the house? I knew there was something wrong. And I will say this to you. The fact that my father was in the program and he had literature laying all around the house and observing you people, I knew that there was something wrong with me. I knew that I needed to stop or at least find out what you people were all about. So I went to my first meeting, September 8, 1975. And I thought maybe I was a little too young to be here. I was a teenager. I was 19. And they 12-stepped me. Two guys 12-stepped me. One had about an afro like this. And I thought, my God, heroin addict. This guy's, you know, listen. You know what I mean? And another guy had real long hair. And they took me to my first meeting. And I thought, low bottom drunks, these guys. So I went to my first meeting, and I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a podium-style meeting where you came up like this, and if you wanted to share, you came up and you shared. I will say this, meetings in 1975 in that area was a little bit different. It was 90 meetings in 90 days. Didn't have any chips. Did no reading except preamble, serenity prayer, into the meeting. They would not let me drive to the meetings. I picked my first sponsor within a week, and I went to a lot of meetings. And I didn't share for 90 meetings. You know, a beginner's meeting, yes, and that's the way it was. And told me to take the cotton out of my ears and shove it in my mouth. I know that might sound a little rough. They also told me if I got drunk that they would punch my lights out. And that New York City cop who was a sergeant, who was 6'6", I believed that he could do that very easily. So I, you know, but understand this. They care. That's the difference. They care. And I went to a lot of meetings. You know, I'll say this, like in the area that I came in, Middletown, New York, we would go to Hartford, Connecticut, a bunch of us in the car, and we would speak at Hartford, Connecticut. A bunch at Hartford, Connecticut would come to our group in Middletown, and they would speak. So I went to a lot of discussions in a car about the 12 steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I knew I was powerless over alcohol. It didn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out, the way I was drinking. And I knew my life was unmanageable. And I knew the second step came to believe that a power of the greater myself could restore my sanity. I really thought I was nuts. But the third step, that word God, I really, really had a hard time with that word God. And I'm not really sure why I had a hard time with that word God. You know what I mean? I grew up, you know, in Yonkers, you know, candy store here, Catholic church right across the street. So you rob the candy store, and then you go confess. You know what I mean? So I had no problem with the Catholic church. And I really had no problem with God. I never forget this. Somebody said, just bear with me. You know, I never had a problem with God. I just always had problems with the people working for him. That seemed to be my problem, you know? And I was drinking, and I just turned my back. You know what I mean? It was like, you know, I knew what I was doing, that was not acceptable, you know, this power. And so I just refused to look at it. So I continued to turn my back on it. And they would say to me, hey, kid, just don't drink. Don't take yourself so serious. Use the word good orderly direction. And they would say, just use that. And then they would say, tell me a story, some kind of story about themselves. You know what I mean? And I feel very, very, very fortunate that I had those kind of people around me. Tom Carley, I'll say his name now because he passed away. He had 19 years of sobriety when he passed away. Tom Carley, who was one of my drinking buddies, came into the program 6 months after I did. And he came in. Tom had this thing, and he would not listen real well. They told him 90 meetings in 90 days, and he'd take the cotton ears and shove it in your mouth. He picked my father as a sponsor, and my father hated Tom Carley because he thought Tom Carley was a bad influence on me. That was not true. But anyway, so Tom Carley comes in the program and he gets out of the service. And Tom just wouldn't keep his mouth shut. He just would not keep his mouth shut. So I've had my sponsor, who was Kenny. I won't give his last name. Kenny. Sanitation worker, New York City sanitation worker. And Tom would, after he had 90 days, he would say, Tom, another 90 meetings in 90 days. Because in those days, you didn't raise your hand. You just didn't do that. There was no such thing as volunteer. And you got through the meetings real quick. You know what I mean? If the topic was not drinking, don't drink, go to meetings. Okay. Don't take yourself so serious. Yo, what's your problem? It was like, you know, you can get through all this room right here real fast in New York. You know what I mean? But Tom was like, and my father would down with the hand. So my sponsor would sit on this side of Tom. My father would sit on this side of Tom. Every time Tom went up with his hand, my sponsor would go in with the elbow, and my father would take his hand down. And every time Tom would talk, I learned a lot from Tom Carlo what not to do. And every time Tom was caught talking to somebody, a lady, my father would walk up to him and say, he's trying to 13-step you, he's full of crap, and then walk away. You know, I'm so tough. So I was like, I get it. I know what not to do. You know what I mean? So God bless Tom Carlo. He stayed sober for 19 years, and he was here. Great guy. So my point is this. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous has been a great, great blessing to me. Great blessing. Tremendous fellowship. And I'm very fortunate I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. About a year living in New York, I decided that I was going to come down to Atlanta. I had been down here once before. I had played with a woman named Alicia Bridges. She hired me as a hired gun to rehearse with her. The girl can do some drinking. I know because I drank with her. And got quite drunk. Matter of fact, the last time I was down here, they took us down to a club called the Alex Cooley's Ballroom, or I think at that time it was called the Ballroom. And the Ramones. Was it the Ballroom? Electric Ballroom. The Ramones and Black Oak Arkansas was playing. And I was a hired gun. The band was a hired gun. Her management, would give us tickets to go watch these acts so we would perform, how they would perform. Before we went down there, we bought some booze on the way down, liquor store, of course. Well, I bought me a fifth. By the time on Buckhead, corner of Buckhead and West Patient Spirit, by the time we got downtown Atlanta, I had drank the entire fifth, except for a very small amount of bomb, which I left for when I was going back. So by the time I got in, went to the bathroom, and that's all I remember. I went into the bathroom, coming out, and that's all I can remember. I remember the Ramones were up on stage. And I thought, this is a comedy act. Because at this time, I guess the punk scene was just coming. I never seen anything like it. And all of a sudden, I was gone. Blacked out, gone. So next night. So evidently, that ticket got wasted on me. But anyway. So I came back to Atlanta, Georgia. My first meeting was the Biscayne Room, 11 o'clock meeting. My second meeting was at Rivas. Has anybody ever been to Rivas? Been to Rivas. Yeah. It's a 1976-77 Rivas Club, the old Rivas Club. The old Rivas Club, which was when you came to the door, Rivas Club went this way. And then way in the back was a, God bless Lynn Blake, I'll say his last name because he's no longer with us. Lynn Blake had a huge chair that was built for him to sit in, way in the back. Are you Frank? I knew your father, brother. Sure did. I knew your father. Matter of fact, your father helped me quite a bit when I first came down here. Yeah. He was a good man. Good man. Met your father, Frank. I also met Louise Smith. I don't know if you remember Louise, the hairdresser. Who went after her husband with a shotgun. Yeah, she was a trip, man. If she didn't like you, if she didn't like what you were saying in the meeting, she'd let you know real quick. She'd let you know, man. I don't like what you're saying. And you're full of, you know, I mean, she was a character. I was scared of Lynn, of Louise Smith. You know what I mean? And so it was a different group there. I got down here, I got me a regular job. You know, the grocery business, Big Star Foods, and I got this job, and I did real well, and, you know, I was down here about a year, and my father came down from New York, and had a nice apartment, and I was sober, and yada, 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 all the normal. And he says to me, son, he says, you're so responsible, you make me throw up. I cut my hair because I thought that was the problem, you know, the long hair and all the hippie stuff and rock and roll music. And he said, why don't you start playing your music again? What are you doing? What are you doing? So that's what I did. I started playing again. And I met this drummer named Bob. I won't go into too much about Bob. Do not blow his anonymity. But Bob was one crazy son of a gun. He traveled all over Europe. He had been everywhere. And I was this young punk kid that came up to him and said, I know how to play bass guitar. And he looked at me like, yeah, sure you can play bass guitar. And so we got together, and we started putting a band together, and we started traveling. I want to say one thing about the Rebus Club. We had done, I guess you guys do like band stuff. But yeah, okay. We had done that for Rebus. And we were doing a show. We had a barbecue. And we had this female comedian. I won't say her name. And she was doing the comedy routine between us. And as we're doing the comedy routine, it's like this. She would do a joke, nobody would laugh. And that's bad. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, you start sweating, you start doing this, but nobody's... She'd do another joke, nobody would laugh. And Louis Smith was, you know what I mean? Every tough crowd. She would turn around and go to me, this is one tough crowd, man. Nobody was laughing. So we would play some more, and then she'd come up and tell them some more jokes. About 4 or 5 years later, she becomes very famous. And I'm going, oh my God, she bombed at the Rebus Club. And now she's a star. How did she do that? So if you want to really try out your material, go to Rebus Club. Get it worked out at Rebus, and then find out where you were going to end up later. So they were brutal down there, man. Rebus was brutal. Whew. So anyway, so continued to go to meetings, went to Rebus, and went on the road with Bob, did a lot of traveling, met a lot of people, went to a lot of meetings out of town. I get in town, you call up Central or the area, you know, their office, AA, and go to meetings. And I met some great people, man. I met some great people. I'm very, very fortunate that way. Let me say this to you. We are all fortunate. We are all fortunate. Because it doesn't matter where you are or where you are in this country or who you are. You say you're an alcoholic. Instantaneous fellowship. Instantaneous. I have talked to people on the road I have never met on the phone saying, I am having a tough time. I need to go back in that club. I need somebody to talk to. And they would get somebody on the phone with me on that payphone and talk me down to get back in that club. Or they would come and get me and take me to meetings, me and Bob to meetings. Or I would find out, I mean, I've met some great, great people who have been more than willing to help, to be of service. And I don't think if I called the local bar in Daytona Beach and say, I'm having a tough time, would you come and get me? I don't think they would. I don't know. Unless I had a grand on me, maybe they would. I don't know. And maybe depending on what club. You know. So, anyway, I did that for a while with Bob. And got off the road, Daytona Beach. And talking about the 12 steps, where are we at? The fourth step. The fourth step took me a long time to get through. Let me say something to you about the 12 steps. If you don't want to change, don't do the 12 steps. If you don't want to change, if you don't want to have a spiritual awakening, if you don't want to have a relationship with God, don't do the 12 steps. Don't make any effort in doing it. Because, you know, the only way I was able to develop a relationship with the power is by moving to the 12 steps. And I want to tell you something. I did not want to do them. I did not want to do a fourth step. I did not want to have a relationship with a God. I didn't jump on any of these steps because I thought it was a great idea. The only time I moved through the 12 steps was I was in so much pain emotionally that I thought, if I don't do something, I'm going to get drunk. I need to move. I need to get into action. The fourth step got real easy for me after I got back off the road. And I thought, the big book, I'm opening up this rascal and I'm taking this step. That was 23 years old when I took a thorough inventory. Up to that point, I hemmed and hawed. I'm not sure. I didn't know what a resentment was. I didn't get a resentment or understood what it was until I came here. You know what I mean? I thought I was entitled to be angry. I thought I was entitled to be pissed off. But that was the norm, because that's what I saw in my family. That's what I saw, the norm. Drinking, violence, anger, hatred. That's what I saw. Until I see my father. Everybody got a screwdriver? I do this for a living. I can tighten this up right now for y'all. Just a little turn of screw. Let me say the 12 steps. My point is the 12 steps, Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't really, it took me a while to get through the 12 steps. You know what I mean? It took me continuous action to get through the 12 steps. It took a while for me to get through them. And I don't push my sponsees. I don't push them through the 12 steps. I'm not a babysitter. I don't call them up and say, did you take your medicine today? What step are you on? If you don't want to do the 12 steps, knock yourself out. Just don't drink. Don't drink. Because eventually you're going to get to them. If you're like me and you want to stay sober, you'll get to them, because I did. Now, that might be against some of your false way of doing the 12 steps, but I did it when I needed to do it. But I've had a spiritual awakening. And I want to say this to you. Because we're getting up to time. This is the very, very critical for me. And be careful who you make amends to and how you do it, because I have done it wrong. Make sure you're doing it with a sponsor, please. Now, I'm going to say some other things, and I'm not going to try to talk you down, because that's one thing I hate, is someone pointing a finger at me who's got time and go, you got to do this, you got to do that. I'm not going to do that to you. I'm not going to do it to you. I'm just going to share you how it was for me, okay? All right? Didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it. Right. Finally got through the 12 steps. Got to continue to take personal inventory. I'm not a saint. There are things after I've had a spiritual awakening and I've developed a relationship with this God, I understand that things are still going to crop up, that layers are going to be peeled off after doing an inventory. And I wrote down the stuff that would bother me. And that some of the stuff that was bothering me was like really stupid. Boss. I was pissed off at him because he was my boss. Okay. It was just stupid crap. But you see, it's all this crap that was in my head that was rattling around that I needed to get down on paper and look at and go, ooh, wow, you got a freaking chip on your shoulder, pal. You really got a chip on your shoulder here. And these fears, oh my God. You know what I mean? Really had to take a hard look at myself and see what was going on with Harry O'Brien. Because it's the inside job. For me, it was the inside job. The internal man had to be changed. Something had to give. There had to be some room. So for me, taking an inventory was getting the room for God's grace to come into my life, the spiritual awakening. Something had to happen. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. I had to continue to improve my conscious contact with God. And I'm not talking about semi-conscious gain or slightly sedated consciousness. I'm talking about present moment awareness. In this room, what is the condition of my heart here? Right now. Am I blocking? Am I living with hatred in my heart? Or am I living with love in my heart? What is it going to be? What is it going to be right now? Am I going to be a vehicle for God's message? Or am I going to be somebody who's going to be destructive? Negative, compulsive. What is the condition of my heart here? Am I willing to open up my heart and to let go? Enough to let you people in and to let this power come into my life. But you people were my example. I needed to see the change in you. I needed to see the guy that I knew that was really, really bad news. That all of his knuckles were twisted. That his nose was twisted. And hearing his story and seeing peace in his eyes. And him saying, hey kid, don't take yourself so serious. It's going to be okay. To me, that speaks more to me than a million priests. To see that change in a man and a woman. Very powerful statement for me. Don't even have to say that much to me. But I could see it in your eyes and in your face. And I knew that's what I needed. I knew I needed peace. I knew I needed something else in my life. You people showed me the way. Thank God for that. Thank God for that. So if you are struggling, please hang around long enough for that change to occur in your life. Because as a man, I'm just going to speak for me as a man, to let down a wall was very, very tough. I felt I needed to keep the wall up for whatever reason. But I found out I did not need to keep that wall up. 1983, I stopped to help this guy on the side of the road. I had come from the swingers club. 11 o'clock meeting. Guy was broken down. I got out of my car to help him. Jumped him off. He was priming the carburetor. Back in those days, it was carburetors. He was priming his carburetor, and I got out of the car. I said, look, get in your car. I'll do this for you. I won't go through the whole spiel, what happened, because sometimes I tell the whole story, and it's like, I can see people cringing. Oh, you know what I mean? It's a full accident. So anyway, he's priming the carburetor. I was priming the carburetor. I pulled my head. I looked. Wasn't the way to get my head out of the car. Try to crank it up. Car wasn't cranking up. Got out of the car, and I said, look, let's give this a couple more times. He told me what he did to the car, what was replaced. I said, okay, let's give this a couple more tries, and that's it. Got back in the car. I went to hit that carburetor with some gas before I got my head out from the car. He hit the ignition. The car backfired, put me on fire and the gas can on fire. Now, fire or water is what I thought. Hit me right smack in the face. I knew there was a creek behind me. A ditch, I don't know what it was, but I knew it was water. I wasn't going out, so I turned around and ran for the water. Come to find out, it was an 8-foot drop for me to get to it. I landed on my back of my head, flames out, I remember that, flames going out, and I came down, beautiful October day, October the 3rd, and I remember seeing my feet coming down, my legs coming down, and it felt like somebody hit my body with a hammer. You ever had that feeling, that numbness from here down? I tried to get up. Wasn't getting up. You got to remember, so I was 28 years old. I ran 5 miles every other day. I did not drink. I did not smoke. I weightlifted every day. I can get up. Tried to get up one more time. And when I tried to get up, I started losing my breathing. And I started losing control of my left hand. Left arm. And I thought, you cannot lose control of your right arm. Next thing I remember, I tried to get one more time and I was not getting up. I knew I was not getting up. And the next thing, I looked up and I see the guy that I was helping standing on top of the hill. Guy froze. I mean, I don't blame him. I was in, one minute I'm helping him and then all of a sudden I'm in flames. You know what I mean? You got a little freaked. The next thing happened, I had this tremendous peace come over me, like a thickness. And I started sensing that something had grabbed a hold of me. And I'm going to relate it to you this way. It's like that first moment that you came into Alcoholics Anonymous, that moment of surrender. And if you're sitting here, I know you have had that experience. But it was like somebody injected all of Cumberland Mall in me. The next thought I thought was, this is it. I'm dying. I'm going. No fear. There was nothing that I felt I needed to be afraid of. And I thought, I wonder how my family is going to take this. And I hope that they're going to be okay. Because I knew I was going to be okay. I had got no message of to be afraid. I've got you. It's going to be okay. Then I was laying there, and then this next crazy thought came to me. Harry, you're going to learn more about yourself than you've ever been learning about yourself before. Something to that effect. Now, that is the most craziest goddamn statement. At this moment, I'm not really having a good day. You know what I'm saying? Things are kind of tough. And about that time, and I know the time is getting short, and somebody jumped down in there, yelled, go, somebody call for an ambulance. They got me out of the ditch. I ended up at Smyrna Hospital. Burnt. They cut the clothes off me. I was soaking wet. I was blood all over me. And had to cut my clothes off me. And it took me to Northside Hospital. They put me in traction. And I never forget this. The doctor just kept saying, well, why don't you say, like use some kind of word of profanity. You know what I mean? He was like pissed off, this neurologist. You know what I mean? It was like, you know what I mean? So he put me in traction in intensive care. And I was in intensive care at Northside Hospital. And they started letting people in. They started letting a lot of people in. Everybody that knew me. And I've said this before. Just if you're in intensive care, you might want to ask, am I going to live? Because, you know, you're letting everybody in here. I don't think that's the norm, that you let everybody in here in intensive care. You know what I mean? Well, where's the doctor? And the odd thing is that, and I'm going to wrap this up real quick. My intensive care nurse had 30 days in the program. 30 days. And she heard us talking about AA. No coincidence that she was there. They moved me to North, and then we got her to meetings, AA meetings. And we would talk the program while she was with me. While she was with me. So they moved me to Shepherd's Spinal Clinic. There's a lot, let me say this, in the medical field, I didn't try to blow everybody's mind. There's a lot of nurses that are in the program. You know what I mean? I mean, I'd be off the handle somewhere, and some nurse would walk up with a sugar bag saying, easy does it. You know, and hand it to me, you know, while I'm laying there in bed. And somebody had the audacity to put the Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace, the Francis prayer, on the wall behind me in my room, probably about half the size of that. So every morning I woke up, I'd look at that prayer, Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. You know what I'm saying? I'm having a tough time here. I don't know if I want to be an instrument, you know? You know what I'm saying? I don't want to be a channel of love and faith and despair and be comfort. I want somebody to comfort me. You know, but I knew I couldn't do that. That's where the rubber met the road, and I knew that. I knew that. It was time to start with the mouth, and I had to start practicing, even though I didn't want to, because I knew I needed to. So let me say this. Unfortunately, it's running out of time. Let me say this to you. My life is totally different than what it was. Totally different. And it's been a great life. I've had some tough times. Had some tough moments. But you people have been there to bring me through it. Have been able to bring me through it. And God bless Bill Hart, because he would listen to my crap. And saying, hey, kid, just don't take yourself so serious. Today you're a winner. So if you're having a tough time, you got to hang in there. Because it will turn around. Everything comes to pass. Everything comes to pass. Good, bad, it all comes and it all passes. But how am I going to deal with it? How am I going to? Am I going to be of service and consumed about Harry O'Brien? Is that going to be my message? Or am I going to be a vehicle of God's love and grace? No matter what comes down the pike. No matter what comes down the pike. You people have given me that and showed me that. And I am eternally grateful for you and your love and you would smile at me and go, "Well, here we go. This guy's a sick cookie." And smile at me and say, "Don't drink 30 minutes and don't take yourself so serious." And you're going to the next meeting and you're cheering. You know? So enjoy your life, gang. Understand this. And I really, if you get anything else out of me, this I want you to understand. No matter what you're going through in your life, you're laying in bed, you're having a tough time, but you're going to get through it. And we are there to help you. But you've got to reach out to us. You've got to reach out to this God. Because we will be there. And we are relentless. Thank you very much. I appreciate you listening. Thank you.
Sorry, before I get off here, where's the screwdriver? I'm putting that thing out right now. We're going to take it apart.
Awesome. What a great example of emotional sobriety. Thank you very much, Harry.
We'll all be together on that broad highway.